Chag Sameach, Mo'adim L'Simcha. I am here with my beloved colleagues in our beloved Gan Chapel. We are taping this class on the first day of Chol Hamoed Pesach, 5784. That would be April 25th, and you're watching it on Shabbat Chol Hamoed, April 27th. Our colleagues, this has been a very challenging season. I want to frame our conversation, our Torah conversation, by just beginning with a challenge. We all sat down to our Seder tables on Monday night with the knowledge that the Columbia's campus had erupted in this encampment of Jew hatred and anti-Semitism and anti-Israel sentiment. By the time we sat down to our Seders, we knew that it had spread to NYU and it had spread to Yale. And then over the course of the first 2 days of Pesach, it spread to places we had hoped it would never go. It had spread down to the south, to the University of Texas at Austin. It had spread to Michigan, to Ann Arbor. We had hoped that the Midwest and the South would be places where Jew hatred would not flourish. It spread to Emerson College locally. It spread to USC. And as I was following these stories, I just kept thinking about Ariel Berger's book, Witness. Ariel Berger was a graduate student of Elie Wiesel, and he wrote a book that won a bunch of awards a few years ago called Witness, about the lessons of Elie Wiesel. And Ariel Berger points out that in Elie Wiesel's first class at BU, in all the classes he taught for all the years, his first class lecture, according to Ariel Berger's book, was always a madness descended on Germany, and a madness descended on Eastern Europe. And the madness was that really good people, they were poets and philosophers, they loved this poet and that poet. They loved music. They loved symphony. They loved this composer, that composer. They were mensches. They were great to their dogs, and they were great to their cats. They were loving children to their parents and loving parents to their children. They were wonderful neighbors. The only thing is, they were really good with killing Jews. And Wiesel talked about that madness. And I just thought about that passage from Ariel Berger's book, this Pesach, which is that a madness is descending, and I wanted to name the madness and then reach out to you, Elias, because your son Mike is at the epicenter of it. He's at Columbia and JTS. But the madness is that the, you know, faculty and students at our nation's best schools, they're not anti-war, and they're not pro-ceasefire. They're anti-Israel. They're making statements about bombing Tel Aviv. They want to bomb Tel Aviv. From the river to the sea, there will be no more Israel. And that it is now axiomatic at all these encampments that there should be no Israel. Right? So the brightest faculty and the brightest students are against Israel's right to exist. That in any kind, they're not saying two-state solution. They're saying bomb Tel Aviv. That's not anti-war. Bomb Tel Aviv is not anti-war. Bomb Tel Aviv is just there should be no Israel. And so to name it, it's madness that it's spread across the country. It's madness that it's now in the South and the Midwest. It's madness that it's faculty and students. And it is madness that it includes Jews. Jews, plenty of Jews, who have turned on the Jewish state. Jews who, you know, Mike Johnson, who came to Columbia yesterday, and I watched the Lester Holt segment, and he was interviewing a Jewish woman. She says, I'm a Jew, but I'm pro-Palestine. I'm a Jew, but I'm against Israel. I'm a Jew, but I'm against Mike Johnson. I'm a Jew, but I'm for these encampments. And there's a lot of that kind of energy. So I first just wanted to name, that's the obvious issue. And I wanted to start with you, Elias, because Mikey is there at the epicenter of it at Columbia. And if you could share the story about his first Seder, and then go around before we frame how this encounters our texts and our Torah study today.
Okay. So has been an interesting season as you describe it. My wife and I, we've been blessed this Passover with relatives coming from a different country to visit us, the nephews, and they are here, and we were lovingly having a lovely Spanish seder, Spanish and Hebrew seder, but at the same time we were with our phone constantly checking with Mikey. Checking with Mikey because Mikey spent the first night of Passover at Hillel. Hillel is, if I recall correctly, is on 115 and Broadway. His dorm is in at the JTS, 122nd and Broadway. So it's only 7 blocks. But the blocks are not only with the pro-Palestinians, but people outside the campus protesting as well, who are not students. So that was a little complicated. He went with a few friends to from his dorm to Hillel around 6 p.m., but then we were concerned about returning. So Hillel in Columbia Barnard, they have been great. They contact the NYPD, and when the seder was over, Mikey was taken by a NYPD cruiser from 115 to 122nd. Two other kids were in the cruiser as well, and he got safely there. But look what I'm talking about. Look what I'm saying. A police car driving him because he could not be safe. And you know, kids are kids. They are, you know, just, oh my God, the driver was so nice to me, you know. So there is some kind of sweetness left, which I hope he never loses. But it's, I don't know, it's something that we never imagined he would have to experience.
Yeah, and Elias, just in addition to just asking you how does this make you feel, which is kind of a cliched question, I wanted to point out an irony that I think Michelle had pointed out in our last class, when we never would have dreamt that Mikey would need a police cruiser escort to go from the Seder to his dorm room. But she pointed out that, you know, you grew up in Argentina, Buenos Aires, and the destruction of the Jewish buildings in Buenos Aires was the formative event in your personal biography, and you grew up knowing anti-Semitism, and so you wanted to come to a country where your kids would never know anti-Semitism, and now your son needs a police cruiser to go in New York City from the Kraft Hillel house to his dorm at the seminary. How do you process the asymmetry that actually his anti-Semitism may be in its own way as painful as yours?
I think it's more painful. I think it's more painful because my kind of anti-Semitism was always one-on-one. It was never like organized groups, mobs, you know. This is completely different. I mean, there were the two big bombings in Argentina, but I never experienced like walking through a group of kids chanting "Dead to the Jews," you know? It was something one-on-one that I would encounter often. And yeah, it's incredible. I mentioned in our talk, in, you know, the first day of Passover, I mentioned that, you know, always as a kid, Mikey and David would ask me about situations that I experienced or Lorena experienced as, you know, growing up in Buenos Aires. But always the ending would be the same. You don't have to worry. These things don't happen in America. Mm. You don't have to worry. I remember vividly there were kids and they were desperate to watch Fiddler on the Roof, the movie. And there is a scene about the, you know, they take all the villages, the Jewish villages, and they started crying. The boys started crying. And I said to them, don't worry, that will never happen again. You know, those things don't happen anymore.
Wow. Well, on that cheery note, Michelle, I know that, you know, I've loved you for 25 years, and you're always the nobler angel seeing the brighter side. And I sense that this moment is a bit different for you, and even for you, Michelle, the angel seeing the bright. It's hard for you to see the bright. So tell us about your neshama in these dark days. And note also that that Maya, your daughter, is at Harvard, which is, you know, the next battle in this front.
Yeah, I don't think we have a map for this. And going back into the Shoah, of course, it's tempting. You know, there are all the pictures of people standing out front of universities in Germany trying to prevent Jewish students from coming in, and you say, oh my gosh, it's happening again. But, you know, Elias, I think you're onto something, that this is different, but it's different in its own way. And we don't have, I think for me, what's so troubling is I don't have a category yet to put this to help me understand where we will go from here. And to me, that's very dislocating, and it's very scary. Our children are on campuses, and all of our Temple Emmanuel family that is out there on this world, does this escalate? Do American values come into play of no place for hate? How do we move from here? Where does this go?
All right. Okay, so Michelle, on that note, can we just process this for a second? Because I'd love your help in understanding the following double standard. If a student wanted to put an encampment up at Columbia or Yale or Harvard saying, we want to go back to Jim Crow, would love to be able to lynch black people whenever we wanted, or would love to go back to owning black people as slaves, okay? They would be railed out of town right away, as they should. That's not protected free speech, that's hate speech, and there should be zero tolerance for that. And in fact, Taylor Swift has a line in a song, she yearns for 1830 without the racism, and she just got endless heat for that line, okay? So you can't say, you cannot say, and properly, you cannot say, you know, we should be able to own blacks or lynch blacks again. That's hate speech. And yet in campus after campus, what they're saying is the Holocaust is good. Jews don't deserve a homeland. There's 7 million Jews. We don't care about them. They can die. The Jewish people can die. They're not protected. No homeland for the Jewish people is, in fact, the moral equivalent of Jim Crow for black people or slavery for black people. No homeland for the Jewish people is the exact moral equivalent. And yet they're treated so differently on college campuses. There's zero tolerance, as there should be, for hate speech directed against all these other groups, as there should be zero tolerance. But there's total tolerance for hate speech directed against the Jewish people. How do you process that double standard?
So I think I'm not doing a great job processing that. I'm mystified right now why the encampment, which with signs set up on the yard saying that this will not be tolerated, was allowed to go on for so long, has been allowed to gain a foothold there on Harvard Yard. I am mystified why the menorah needs to come down every night because they can't protect it, but the apartheid wall gets 24/7 guarding to make sure that no one vandalizes it. My compass is off here, and I search our sources. I'm trying to go back to understand how we understand that the responses that one would expect are not forthcoming.
Okay, so Mr. Nesson, we are hoping that you earn your title, Lord Nesson. We'd love some insight from you. How are you processing this unreal period?
Yeah, I'm you know, with Michelle about the fact that it is totally a mystery why these things are allowed. I was thinking about, we were talking earlier before the class started about the initiation of COVID and the pandemic and the idea that some things are age old and we are unable to eradicate it. And it seems that it's pretty clear that anti-Semitism has never gone away, you know, from the year, you know, the year 1000 or whatever, but it seems like something that we just, it's always there, and it just needs a small spark in order to be able to come back to process. And, you know, as you mentioned, one of the schools is USC, you know, where Emma graduated from, and even while she was there, so that was, you know, almost 3 years ago, you know, she recognized the fact there that there was on that campus, it was already there was already anti-Semitism on that campus. You know, and so this is something that has not ever gone away. And then you mentioned Yale. I just want to a brief story about, you know, our friend Stephen Greenblatt, who when he went to Yale was as a freshman was up for. He told the story from the Bema that he was up for a. For a very prestigious scholarship, and when he went to speak to the to the head of the department, the head of the department, this is, you know, he said, oh, Greenblatt, that's a Jewish name. We don't really want to have, you know, Jews controlling our school. And this is back in the 50s. So it's always there and won't go away. And again, most of the time I'm hopeful. And I'm less hopeful now. It's just
I was going to say something on the optimistic side.
Well, before we do, I want to, so let's just pause in the conversation. There's a lot of darkness in the space because the areas are dark and the conversation is dark. And the question is how to not stay there and what's the wisdom of our sources. So I want to now enter the Torah piece of the conversation. And Michelle, when we were talking last week, you had a fabulous insight, which is that on the eighth day of Pesach, we say Yizkor. And you noted that we only say Yizkor for dead people. We never say Yizkor for dead ideas or dead ideals. And since you made that point, that has been sticking with me. We say Yizkor for our parents, for our siblings, for our spouses, for our children, God forbid, and for friends. But we don't say Yizkor for ideals and ideas that seem to have died. And I've been sitting with that. So what I wanted to do is, actually now let's just thank God for the gift of Torah, because we need some Torah, and then we're going to jump into that content.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam,
asher kishanu mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah, v'harev na Adonai Eloheinu et divrei Toratcha b'finu v'fi amcha beit Yisrael, v'nihye anachnu v'tzatzaeinu v'tzatzaei amcha beit Yisrael, Kulani Yodei Shemecha Melamei Toratecha Lishma, Baruch Atah Adonai Melamei Torah Lamo Yisrael, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam, Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Amim V'Natan Lanu Et Torato, Baruch Atah Adonai Notein HaTorah. So I want to bring to the conversation in a moment kind of the anatomy of a dead idea from the Torah's point of view. Like the Torah actually speaks directly to this. What happens when an idea dies? What happens when an ideal dies? What happens when you feel like you're in a dark place with dead ideals and you don't say Kaddish is the answer? And the Torah has a different narrative of what you do. But first, you said you had some optimism, so we're always in the market for optimism.
No, I wanted to, just shortly, I want to say a couple of things that I believe that we should take in consideration. One is that students at college campuses is only one segment of the American population. It's only one segment. I don't know exactly what percentage it is. I want to believe that the rest of the country, the adult people living there, don't feel that way. Okay? Mm. And I've seen it many times when I read posts, you know, on Instagram or in Facebook, things that are against, you know, news about against the Jews, and then some adults, random adults, good heart people say, just make sure that you feel that we in the rest of the country, we don't feel that way. That's one thing that I wanted to bring. And second is that in 2 weeks, school is over, all right? There is one more week of classes and then the last week of exams. And they don't go back until September. So it's 3.5 months. 3.5 months is an eternity these days in relationship with what could happen to Israel and Hamas, what could happen to the hostages, what could happen to American society. So let's remain hopeful.
Okay, amen to that. So Michelle, let me turn to you, and I've got a text and a whole methodology from Devarim, but since you came up with this really, I thought, helpful dichotomy, people die and we remember them in Yizkor, but ideas, our tradition doesn't let us say Kaddish for a dead idea. What did you mean by that?
I think I felt it on two levels. The first level is this, you know, crassly people say, you know, mugged by reality. There are senses where you feel like you really believed an ideal, and then the world around you does not give you the facts to support that ideal, and you have to come to grapple with the sort of Shvoch Hamatcha moments of our tradition that, wow, maybe all those who said that you shouldn't be so naive, you shouldn't be so optimistic, maybe they were all right. So there's that piece of it.
Right, the right wing cranks were right.
So there's that piece, right? Like, yeah. how do I say yisker for that part of me that is so hopeful, that believed that we were in a different time and that the Jewish people were moving into a place where we're not only accepted but also valued in society, dragged right back into Fiddler on the Roof, right? So there's that piece of it. And can you say yisker for that part of yourself that was so valuable, that was so precious? And then the second piece of it is that I love that we don't say yisker, because in a sense, I think that challenges us to say that actually ideas and ideals never do die. And there may be points and periods where, yes, it's true, the Shvoch HaMatcha moment, the Bechol Dor Vador, Omdim Aleinu, in every generation they rise up against us, is there and more pronounced. So too are the Bechol Dor Vador, Chayav Adam Lerot Et Atzmo. So in every generation, we do go out. And that, in some sense, by not saying Yisker, our tradition kind of demands of us that we not give up so easily.
Great. So thank you for that beautiful framing. I wanted to bring into the conversation the greatest single idea in the Torah, and the single greatest ideal in the Torah. What all of the Torah is about is a covenant at Sinai between God and the Jewish people. And the covenant is God will be our God and we will be God's people. And that we receive the Torah, we'll learn the Torah, we'll do the Torah, we'll follow the laws of the Torah. God will take us to our land, and we'll build a just and righteous, compassionate society in our land of beloved Eretz Yisrael, following the laws of the Torah, and there will be the Jewish people in the Jewish homeland doing the will of God, their covenantal partner. And that's the idea of the Torah. And the Torah itself acknowledges that is going to die many times. And the Torah itself acknowledges it, and basically it provides the following methodology. We're going to screw up. We're going to violate the laws of the Torah. God's going to get really steamed. We're going to suffer grievously, punishments, etc. Among those punishments will be exile. And we will be saying, the Torah itself says this in Deuteronomy, oh, there's no God. There's no God. Look, the people are exiled. And people will be saying, oh, we are gone forever. And people will be saying there is no hope. And people will be saying there is no future. And people will be saying there is no God. And then the Torah says, and what's going to happen is you're going to try again. And you're going to, and I'm going to take you back in love. So what I want to do is I want to just take a look and read some of the scheme for you. Because it's both very, very, very dark and then very, very, very light and hopeful, and see how these ancient words speak to today. So I'm just going to read a little bit of this. This is in Deuteronomy, Parshat Netzavim, later Deuteronomy. Later generations will ask the children who succeeded you and foreigners who come from distant lands and see the plagues and the diseases that the Lord has inflicted upon that land, all its soil devastated by sulfur and salt, beyond sowing and producing, no grass growing in it, just like the upheaval of Sodom and Gomorrah, which the Lord overthrew in his fierce anger. And the nations will ask, why did the Lord do thus to this land? Wherefore that awful wrath? And they will be told, because they forsook the covenant that the Lord God of their fathers made with them when he freed them from the land of Egypt. They turned to the service of other gods and worshiped them, gods whom they had not experienced and who he had not allotted to them. So the Lord was incensed at the land and brought upon it the curses recorded in this book. The Lord uprooted them from their soil in anger, fury, great wrath, cast them into another land, as is still the case. And so the way that this whole fairy tale story ends, with fairy tale ends with a nightmare, we get expelled and exiled, which of course is the story of Jewish history. But it doesn't end there. We don't say Kaddish for an idea or an ideal. Thank you, Michelle. Then the very next chapter, when all these things befall you, the blessing and the curse that I have set before you, and you take them to heart amidst the various nations to which the Lord your God has banished you, and you return to the Lord your God, and you and your children heed his command with all your heart and soul, just as I enjoin upon you this day, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and take you back in love. He will bring you together again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you, even if your outcasts are at the ends of the world. From there the Lord your God will gather you. From there he will fetch you. And the Lord your God will bring you to the land that your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. And he will make you more prosperous and more numerous than your fathers. And then the Lord your God will open up your heart and the hearts of your offspring to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul in order that you may live. And so it goes. In other words, you're going to try again, and God is going to give us another shot. So we never say Kaddish for a dead idea. What do you guys think about that in its own context? And is there any meaning from those verses that could be helpful to us today?
The context is complex because it assumes that the initial part, that God's wrath is because of something that we have done.
Right.
And the question is, you know, what in the modern age, what has Israel done? Except for basically be startup nation, you know, and creating so much good for the world.
Right.
I mean, the percentage of Nobel Prize winners, scientists, doctors, you know, people that just do good for the world, is so doesn't match our percentage as a people. So what is it that we have done, except for perhaps create jealousy among the nations? What have we done that God would then, you know, pour out his wrath upon us at this point? I don't get that. Right.
So what I hear you saying is you don't love the note of self-flagellation and self-blame in this. Right, and I'm with you.
Taking responsibility is one thing.
Right, and just to be clear, I think that's a really helpful point. Dan, I also don't love the self-flagellation and the self-blame, etc. And I think it's worth saying that the sin of Israel, if you were to test all these 20 college campuses where there's encampments, the sin of Israel is the original sin that it exists. Right. Its existence is the sin. It's not 67, and it's not the Gaza War. The sin of Israel is its very existence. All of these position, all of these encampments take the position that the founding of Israel was a moral mistake which must be rectified. And therefore, I'm with you that the note in this text about self-blame, not helpful. Michelle, you're ready to say something.
I just think, yes, I agree with the idea that clearly on the encampments, it's 1948, it's the existence of the state.
Original state.
Nothing to discount that. And, right, when you say, oh, I don't know what Israel has done, there are certainly from a liberal college student perspective, you look at the tens of thousands of Gazans who have been killed, and there is something that I don't think we do ourselves a favor as Jews when we say, you know, oh my God, Israel has never done anything that is challenging. And there are those of us, you know, I think over time, each of us has had a question of, you know, a child is a child is a child wherever you are. And yes, it is true, we must attack our enemies. But might we quibble with the moral aspect of a nation in defending themselves, of trying to preserve a sense of that Yerushalayim Shalmala, the holy Jerusalem, that is very careful about that. And I think there are Israelis out on the streets of Israel who would say today, from different political perspectives, that they would like that their government had made different decisions along the way on any number of issues. So I don't think we serve ourselves well when we say that it's completely incomprehensible that somebody should have concerns. I think we serve ourselves better when we say, yes, and look at what we're facing. When you face an enemy like the one we face, one has to defend oneself, and one has to live by this.
Okay, so what I hear in your machloket, L'shem Shemayim, Dan and Michelle, is how do we regard in the tradition's classic posture about dead ideals? The first thing is self-blame and self-criticism, and what did we do wrong? Because of our sins, we were exiled from our land. That's in the liturgy, and that's in Deuteronomy, not those exact words, but certainly the thought that we're thrown out of the land because of something we did wrong. And Dan, you've raised some concerns about self-blame. Michelle, I hear you saying that some self-scrutiny is helpful, and that we serve ourselves by that. Okay, so let's just hold that. What about the next note, though, that instead of Kaddish, we come back, we try again, God will take us back in love, and that we're going to be stronger and better than ever. So what I wanted to just observe about Deuteronomy, Tzavim's scheme, is the darkness is super, super dark. I mean, super, super dark. As you guys know, and our folks who go to shul know, that when we read these prophecies about the bad stuff, they're so dark that they're usually whispered, like they shouldn't be stated out loud. That's tochacha, the castigation in Ki Tavoh and in the end of Leviticus, B'chukotai. Those are whispered because they're too horrific to even say out loud. Super dark. But here, the hopeful part is super hopeful. You're going to be better and stronger than before. What do you do with that kind of whiplash? It's so dark, and then it's so hopeful. Is that real? Is that credible? What's the message of that rebound to us? Elias, you're strangely silent. What do you got to say?
No, I've been thinking a lot about, I love a lot of the things that have been said here today. I do believe in revisiting all ideals that could be reserved by the things happening in the world at certain periods of time. I've been thinking a lot about this idea that we see, with reason, we see Israel as you know, our homeland and our brothers and sisters, and all of us have relatives there. Okay, all of us have relatives there. I have friends that I grew up with, went to Jewish day school. They made Aliyah, but you know, this could be a topic for another class. I have nine first cousins in Israel. All of them are agnostics. Okay, all of them are Israelis, Zionists, who don't believe in God. So this idea that God will punish us for our mistakes is completely bogus to them, okay? It's completely, so to a certain point, I would relate more the self-criticism of what was happening in Israel before October 7 with Netanyahu's government and all the protests and everything, rather than, you know, what Israel is doing, because I honestly don't believe that Israelis and the decisions of the government of Israel are based on the Torah.
Right. But I just want to say, I mean, I don't think we need to get hung up on this note of God will punish or self-screen. I mean, it's clear that Israel itself is doing a cheshbon ha-nefesh, about a spiritual inventory and accounting about how did October 7th happen. Right before Pesach, the guy who was the head of military intelligence resigned and said, I take accountability. So whether or not you put God in the story, if God is a noun or not in your narrative, it doesn't matter. Come to your own conclusions, all good. But even if you don't, clearly we need to learn from mistakes, and clearly everybody makes mistakes, and clearly a society that learns from their mistakes is going to be better off than one that doesn't. And Israel's already doing that. I mean, after the Yom Kippur War, Golda resigned, and there was just a whole commission about how do we screw up 73. And the same thing has begun to happen and will happen once we, if and when we get out of this mess, will happen more. So accountability is part of it. I guess what I'm asking for is, in addition to the accountability, the scrutiny is good, accountability is good, learning from our mistakes is good. Who could argue with that, whether it's God or we do it ourselves. What do you think about this note of resilience in particular? I mean, I think what I feel about my alma mater, which is divorced, I just feel I'm 5 miles from Harvard. I'm a million miles from Harvard emotionally. I feel divorced from it. I can't believe that it was ever that important to my life, and it was at one point, and feels so distant now. And I have heard other alumni, and from the emails I get from the Jewish Alumni Network of Harvard, they just feel extremely estranged and distanced. I'm wondering, can that ever get reborn with love and be stronger than ever? It's just very hard, and that's my question. Will America's universities ever be hospitable places for Jews again? Or are we going to be sending our kids to the University of Tennessee if Tennessee hasn't yet, caught this cancer? Does the note of hope and resilience ring true to the world that you're living in, Michelle?
So I think that's one of the hardest parts about this moment, because I so want it to ring true, and there actually are steps that Harvard, that Columbia, that Yale, that all, right on down the list could take to move, to switch this conversation. And at this point, it actually wouldn't be that much, right? They simply have to come out and say, we are great with free speech. We're great with people holding the ideas that they hold. We're not okay with hate speech. And we're not okay with targeting Jews on campus for some sort of a connection or a love of Israel, which that's not going to be tolerated here. And even now, if the universities took a strong stance on that, I believe that they could root this out, but there will come a point where that's no longer the case. And I don't know where that line lies. I do think that this beautiful tradition of not saying Yisker asks us when it's really hard, when our compass feels totally off, to say, yes, that's how it is today. Right. And
Let me just bring this class to a close with the following observation. All right, it is really hard in the darkness to not surrender to the darkness, right? But if you just go back, if we go shopping in our own closet, and we look at Jewish history from 1941 through 45, and then again in 1948, we see that the response to all that madness in Europe and all that it cost our people, one third of our people, our response to that was not Yikadal v'Yikadash. Our response to that was Hatikva, right? And I think that our national anthem and the Hatikva flows from this really different kind of passage in Deuteronomy, that we don't say Kaddish for dead ideas. We try again and we try again and we try again, and that is why we are the people of Hatikva, and it's precisely when it's hardest to hold on to that, that it is the most important to hold on to that. Shabbat shalom and chag sameach.